You see, that went so wild. Well, in the meantime, of course, I also fell in love on top of it all and met my future wife. And well, by 22, 23, we thought, well, eventually, I was, after all, 22 years old, and you'd think of eventually getting married once. But it was impossible that we would have even been able to rent a small apartment, even with two rooms, a kitchen and a bedroom. So we tried yet to buy some of the kitchen utensils, pots and pans and the like. And we found a set in a store in a nearby city. And we priced it 150,000 marks for just a simple kitchen utensils, enameled pots and pans. Well, I didn't, up till then, I had never had earned that much, 150,000 mark. I never had earned that much, not even near it. So I went to the bank and asked them to whether I could have some money, that much money on a short-term loan. Yeah, so I got the 150,000 mark, and we went and bought the utensils. Then one day I had to go to the blast furnace and pick up something there, and coming through the other village, which was on the other end of the valley from us, I saw a beautiful kitchen range. And oh, I said, that is nice, that'd be good. So I priced it 2 million marks. 2 million marks. So I, of course, wanted to do the same thing. I went home and told my girlfriend about it, and I said, a wonderful stove, white enamel and all. And so I went to the bank to get the 2 million, a short-term loan, and they said, no more short-term loans. So, and here I wanted to have that stove too. So I went to my uncle. He was, of course, perhaps the largest businessman in our small town, and told him what had happened. And he took his apron off and he said, I get you the money right away. So he went to the bank and he brought the check for 2 million marks. So we, of course, hitched two cows to the small farm wagon, and off we went over the mountainside. And as we got there, must have been a little after 4 o'clock, and the woman said, no, you can't have that ranch anymore. I said, I have the money. No, she figured that tomorrow she could ask 2.5 million for it.
Horrendous inflation.
Yeah.
Just almost sounds almost like a
absolutely
joke.
unbelievable. So, well, finally, my wife, of course, was with me too, and or at that time, my girlfriend. She was a very good looker too. She made somewhat. She talked to the man, you know, the store owner, and he finally softened up. He said, "Oh, let the two young people have the stove." And so, I gave him the 2 million, and we loaded on the wagon because we got probably home by dark already, because cows are very slow. They don't go like a horse.
This is a horrendous environment to be
Yeah,
living in.
yeah. Well, we had no room to put the stove either. We had in our home, that our home was not sold where I was born. My mother insisted that that was supposed to be left. The rest of the furniture and everything was supposed to be sold, but the home was supposed to be left for us eventually. Well, I had a small room at a time where they put the linen and things, bed sheets and the like, and pillowcases and all what these two women had probably accumulated in a lifetime, and which was extremely valuable. And of course, most German women, of course, always wanted that linen closet stacked up high. The more linen they had, all the greater a bride they possessed. And so that was still in this small room, together with a couple other smaller furniture pieces. I guess a bed or what was in there too, but it was a comparatively small room. And so we put it in there and hope we would find a place what we could rent, but nothing, we couldn't rent anything. So by then, of course, we were greatly discouraged too. And so there was a man what had lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin, since he had emigrated, I guess, around 1906, between 1906 and 7, something in that area, the way I remember, because we had a boy, one of his boys was in my class when I started off in grade school. And so that's why I remember those dads roughly. And he came out, his wife had been not too well, and the doctor had told him in Kenosha, the best thing would be for her to have a climate change. That would perhaps revive her again. So he came out, of course he had plenty of dollars, and so he bought one of the nicest looking homes in Darden. And then we heard that he also supplied some people with money to go to the United States, because dollars, you see that we couldn't use our own mark. They wouldn't take the mark for the ship's passage. So we naturally had to have either pounds sterling or dollars. So I finally said to her, I said, well, her brother was also in the United States. He moved here in, I guess, only 2 years after the war, the First World War. He moved over here because they had an uncle living in Scotia, right across the river from Schenectady here. And that he was a beggar by trade. They asked him to come over, and he would always find a job as a beggar anytime. And so he did. He moved over here. And so I asked my girlfriend one day, I said, why don't you write to your brother? Maybe he can send us the money that we could leave for good from here. We didn't seem to be able to make out at all out there. So, no, she said, I won't write. I won't write to him. I don't know where he even has saved that much money that he can send us that amount of money. It wasn't a great sum either, about $110 or something like that per person at the time, third class. So then I happened to think, well, why not try that man what came from Kenosha here? He seems to have all sorts of money. So I went there. They lived directly adjacent to my father-in-law. And yes, he says, I don't have enough cash for that, but I have a second mortgage that's due in the fall. And as soon as I have that money, you can have your money. And I was gonna let them have some of that land what I inherited as a, well, more or less as a guarantee that we would pay the money back. And he approached me later on once again. He said, why don't you sell me the stuff outright? You never will come back anyhow. And well, I finally consented to that too. I sold the thing outright, all the property that I inherited from my mother. Now you see, the trouble was there that all the property was divided by the children, you see, mm-hmm. and it became smaller and smaller. Then, of course, my mother used the land that my grandmother had while she lived with us, too. In that way, she had a fairly good farm operation, enough to raise enough grasslands to raise enough hay for to feed the cows over winter. That was one important thing, naturally. And so that, of course, as soon as my mother died, my grandmother's property naturally went to the rest of her children. And so each one got a field or a grass lot or something like that. And while we, of course, had also shared in her inheritance as well, but that was so small that we never could have made fed even one cow on it, maybe a goat. And I wasn't inclined to be a farmer either, anyhow. The hard work that it all meant, because most of the miners, they worked 8 hours a day and then rushed home and did some of their farm work. The hard work, we say, cutting the hay with the scythe by hand, or hauling stuff in and chopping wood and the like, all the heavy work. And while the women, they had to do all the hard work on the fields, like after the potatoes were planted and they started to sprout. And then, of course, the weeds sprouted with it. The weeds, of course, had to be hoed. And that must have been an endless job, too, for the women. And the children as well, because I had to carry that earth up to the upper end on the sloping field. So
did the man's second mortgage come through?
Oh, yeah. Well, they already wrote us, we should hurry. There was a chance that the quota would be filled.
Who wrote you? Did, your girlfriend's?
Her
Were you married
relatives.
To her yet? When did you marry?
No, we finally decided if we want to go, we might just as well get married, then we can at least sleep together on the trip, too, on the ship. And so we did. We got married. And then all of a sudden, in fact, I had quit my job, and that was in 1923. We got married in October 19, 1923. And just about that time, I quit the job after we got the money, you see, and had the passage with the Royal Mail Line from Hamburg. We were supposed to sail. And I quit the work. And we were saying goodbye to all our relatives. So my wife said to me, "You are related to the whole village." I said, "Yes, if we include your relatives yet too, we are related to the whole village." And well, just the day before we were supposed to leave for Hamburg, a telegram arrived from the ship's line that we couldn't go no more because the quota was filled. That was the first time that ever had happened. Germany at that time had 70,000 people that could emigrate to the United States, and that was already filled by October, that 1923. So there we was. Here, we had, in fact, we had packed a big box where some of these kitchen utensils were in and other feather beds and whatnot, and sent that already in to Hamburg. And, of course, they naturally stored it right away on the ship where we were supposed to be sailing with. So I said, well, let it go. They told us on the ship line, they told us, well, you can sail the middle of June, and then when the new quota opens, on the 1st of July, you're right in New York. So, well, that was only after from October 23 to 24, it would have been. But during the winter time, there was all sorts of rumors of some changes. And so I went one time to the American Consul to Cologne and inquired, and they didn't know either. During the session of Congress of 1923-24, they had changed the immigration law. That Germany didn't have that large a quota any longer. They cut the quota down, and I don't know, in favor of perhaps Polish, because the Polish had anyhow a small quota, and so they didn't lose much, and so we had to stay. We couldn't go. Well, that was a fine thing. Here we had no place to live, but my wife and at that time slept with me in my old bachelor's quarters. It was just a bedroom, narrow enough with just a clothes closet and a bed. And what could we do? We naturally then we, however, went and tried to make that we could cook ourselves. We brought the stove from the little room in my home and set that up there so that we wouldn't depend on my aunt and uncle yet, too. And, of course, while we first got married and my wife helped them, and, digging potatoes and the like, and my uncle one day said to me, oh, can that woman work? He said, well, her father was an awfully strict man who made the women work so hard that, and they had to be home at 10 o'clock at night, even though they were 19, 20 years old. They had to be home at 20, they had a big bell on the front door. As soon as they opened that bell, the door, the bell would ring. And the old man naturally turned the light on in the bedroom and checked. Oh, and he was a tough old customer. And so the women knew how to work, all of them. He had five girls and two boys. Big family. Naturally, he must have, as a younger man, acquired a nice home too, and probably had a mortgage. And so each of those girls, as soon as they was confirmed 14 years old, they had to go and work as a maid somewhere for richer people in the nearby or farther away cities. And so those girls naturally was brilliant cooks later on. They learned an awful lot in their years of of slavery.
So now you existed this way until 1925.
Well, yes. So naturally, we first thought we probably never will go. In the meantime, my wife became pregnant. You can't sleep with a beautiful woman night after night and nothing happens, you know. So she became pregnant, and so, of course, finally, then we could never hear from the consul in Cologne, where we had the original visas, but when we could go. And the new law specified that because they had a small depression here too in 21-22, where some factories wasn't too busy and people were out of work slightly, and so they didn't want no industrial workers. Farmers could come, I wasn't enough of a farmer that if they would ask me a ticklish question like, what is the gestation time of a cow? I wouldn't even know that.
So you guys were really in a pickle.
Yeah, that's right. So, but finally, about the girl was just born when we got the letter. We had a be in Cologne council for the visa. And everybody, before only the man of the family father, more or less, had to go to get the papers for the whole family. This time, everybody had to go. It was just, she was still in bed yet when this letter arrived. So she says, I'm going if it costs my life. So the very first thing that she got out of bed was to go on the railroad that morning with me down to Cologne. That was about 80 miles railroad trip too. So I, to be sure that she wouldn't catch any draft or anything or any cold, I bought a first class ticket because those early trains, of course, was full of labor people what would go to work somewhere. And so you could hardly get a decent, and the doors would always open on every succeeding station, they would open up and close again and all. So by buying a first-class ticket, I was relatively sure that we would get safely down to Cologne. Then as we got there, the council was directly behind the cathedral, and the cathedral was, or the railway station was almost directly in front of the cathedral. So we didn't have to walk very far. As we got there to the council, we had all the emigrants had to go the back way. They couldn't go the front up the front way. And so here was the whole stair from the bottom on up, full of people already waiting to until they would open the door, you know, all ready to go to America. And then they finally opened the door and let us in. There was a long room with just plain benches, and we sat on the benches and then waited what would happen next. Finally, a door opened from a corridor, and a man came in, and he announced the first numbers. We had wedding numbers, each one of us, see, which was sent mail to us in our hometown. And so he announced two numbers, two people would go, and I watched how long a time, well, that would take roughly 10 minutes, and then he came and announced another two more numbers. And I then looked at my numbers, I said, we never get home tonight if we wait until our number is called. We had to go because my wife breastfed the baby too. So somehow or another we had to get home. So I said, okay, when the man comes again, I'm going to ask him whether he couldn't take us first, that is such and such was the case, that my wife had just given birth to a baby, and we really didn't have much time, or we would miss the train, but would bring us to our hometown again in time, the last train. So he couldn't understand me. He couldn't. He apparently all he could do is announce the numbers. So he took me by the sleeve and took me into the corridor. It was a long corridor and doors, even leading to the various offices on both sides. And all of a sudden, a tall man came out of one of the doors, and this fellow had me on the arm. He went up to that man and talked to him, and it happened to be the American doctor. So the doctor, of course, also only spoke a broken German, but nevertheless, he understood what my problem was, and he said, where is your wife? Go and get her. And so I quickly rushed out and brought her in, and he brothers into an office with the girls typing and things like that, two or three girls in there. And he looked around and he saw a couple windows open, so he talked to one of the girls. A girl jumped up and closed the window. Then he, of course, had already given my wife a chair to sit down. So that was the very first gentleman I met. Yeah, well, those so are...
Did you get your visa?
Yes. Of course, the girls right away met the visas out, and I said, well, we need health certificates. We don't have them. We thought we would better get them from our health certificate from the American doctor. Well, he says, come in, follow me in my office. So he just took our pulse, and then he wrote out the... Well, I said, we have that baby that... we have a health certificate from her, and he looked at that health certificate. Oh, he said, no, that's no good. Well, I said, couldn't you write one out? He said, well, has she got all 10 fingers, all 10 toes? I said, oh, yes, she is no cripple. She is definitely a healthy baby. So he wrote the thing out, and of course, he charged us $10 each. For our health certificate, and then $5 for the baby.
So were you able to leave soon after?
Right,
this?
We left immediately, and I wanted to. I saw as we walked past the outside in the railway station, there was a money exchange too. So I said, "Well, I would like to change some mark into dollars." So I brought my wife to a waiting room first class in the railway station and then quickly rushed to this place. And then I glanced at some clock I saw. And I said, now what, that's confusing. I had half an hour or an hour difference. At that time, they had the English occupation in Cologne, and they actually had... Western European time, while we had Central European time. Then I did one little thinking. I said, I didn't even go to the exchange. I rushed right back and picked my wife up. I said, we have the rush or we missed our train yet. So as we got up on the platform, oh boy, was that a crowd on that platform. So we didn't... First, momentarily, didn't know what to do, what car we should go into. And then I saw the conductor. He was a friend of the family's. And I talked with him. Oh, he says, that train is filled to the gills. But he said, I know your way out. So he pulled a key out of his pocket, and he had his own first-class compartment that was locked. So he unlocked the apartment, shoved us in, so we got home nicely.
Well, that's good. We need to hurry a little bit along.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me when you left for America?
That was towards the end of January for Hamburg. And there, of course...
So how old is your baby by then?
Maybe, I always said she was 3 weeks or 8 weeks old when we brought her over here. So she must have been...
very young.
Yeah.
Yeah, little.
Yeah. 8 weeks when we brought her to New York. So then, of course, never forget the first morning we stood on deck and looked at that Manhattan skyline, and was a cloudy day. The sky was completely overcast, and of course, the whole buildings, what we could see from the ship, looked awful dreary and not very inviting at all. And there we are. My wife had the baby in her arm, and here I, both of us couldn't speak a word of English. And and opportunity that I would have a job right away either. And here I was with a young family, and I wasn't exactly a worry. Was very black thought in my mind.
How long was the boat ride?
Well, since it was an English ship, they left from Hamburg, crossed the North Sea, and then Southampton was their home port. And they, of course, refueled the ship and as well as put on provisions, too. So we was several days in Southampton. In fact, one day I took the courage and took a walk into the city, and because I wanted to bring a couple of nice oranges. They had such nice oranges there in the stores, and I bought, naturally wanted to buy, but I had to change money first, get some dollars into pounds and shillings, and then came back with the fresh oranges. And
was it a rough trip?
Yes, very rough. We crossed. We had no trouble going to the North Sea. That normally is supposed to be a very dangerous sea. But that was very smooth. We all thought, well, we never get seasick. So as we left from Southampton to France, Cherbourg, and that was okay as we crossed the channel. But when we left that night late from Cherbourg into the open ocean, then, of course, we hit a storm. We wasn't gone very long when we hit a terrible storm. And, oh, boy, we got both so seasick that... good thing they had an old English nurse on board. She took care of the baby. She changed the baby in time and all, and brought some soup to my wife, too. And my wife had said, well, give him a bowl full, too. She said, no, he can't go up. We want something to eat. She would bring it to my wife, but not to me.
What were your accommodations on the boat?
Well, lucky we had... They had a small cabin for us with two birds. One, and I slept, of course, on the upper one, and so it wasn't bad accommodations. While most of the other people, they slept in groups. The women in larger, where they had probably from 6 to 8 bunks, and the men also in a similar condition. So we was yet fortunate that they had given us that small cabin. But when this trouble started, we could hear the waves thunder over the deck. In fact, it had knocked the air conditioning out. See, at that time, they didn't have air conditioning. There was those big vents, you know. But would take in the fresh air, and they had knocked them all out. So it got terribly hot inside because that was still a steam-driven boat. Then if we had any complaints, sometimes we complained that the service wasn't exactly right or something or another. They said, well, this is a German-built boat. It was one of those boats what they had, according to the Versailles Treaty, had turned over to England. And this was the former München or Munich of I don't know which line, either the Hamburg-America line or the Bremen-Lloyd or whichever, I don't know. And they called the ship Ohio. And, of course, while I was in the... taking a walk from the ship while they was provisioning the ship in Southampton, I also saw one of the mighty big German ships in dry dock there. And I guess that was the Fatherland originally, I think, something like that. was an extremely large ship, and they call it Leviathan. The English transferred it into a Leviathan.
Well, so when did you stop being sick? When was the storm over? And
it took several days until the storm finally was up. Then there was a couple fellows from Minnesota, farmers from Minnesota, but had apparently revisited Germany, their old hometown, once more. And those two guys, they were always drunk. They didn't get seasick either. So one morning they knocked on the door and they took my wife between them and brought her up on the fresh air. Then when she came down again, she says, "You got to go upstairs. You get quickly well. That is the only thing." So, of course, later on she took me and I got up there quickly well too. So the rest of the trip was actually wonderful across the Atlantic in the beginning of February to the middle of February when we finally landed in New York.
Do you remember seeing the Statue of Liberty?
Yes. When we actually entered the channel, a fog came in and they had to drop anchor. And there was a hell of a noise. At that time, of course, there was the tunnels wasn't there yet, nor the bridges like George Washington Bridge on the upper end of the Hudson wasn't there yet either. So naturally, everybody had to go on ferries back and forth. And they too, they naturally had to go fog or no fog, they had to go. And our big ship would blow the heavy whistle, and then on the front of the ship, a sailor was ringing the bell constantly. And finally, the fog lifted momentarily, and they raised anchor, and we went up, and then the fog closed in again. Then at 9 o'clock, at night, everything was still with exception of the noises of the ferries. I went out on deck and here we was anchored directly in front of the Statue of Liberty in the channel. And it seemed as if even nature was against us, wouldn't let us in the United States. But once we, of course, got started. What they, her uncle had done, they had rented a small flat in Scotia, and wasn't really a two-family house, but Polish people lived downstairs, and we rented the upstairs, just two bedrooms and a kitchen and a living room.
Talk about Ellis Island.
And they had finished the stuff with discarded furniture, but well, they bought, for instance, I had bought a new kitchen stove. They gave us the old cast iron stove. Well, it was a good start. And then they had a small kitchen table and two beds, a brass bed and then a crib for the baby. So we was had a good start right away.
Talk to me about Ellis Island and being processed at Ellis.
Oh, well, of course, after we went to that they inspected our suitcases and we had another big wooden box, and that was dumped down a chute and probably went right away in the freight yard and was transported up to Scotia. And then we had to board a ferry, which brought us down to Ellis Island. And there, of course, we were separated immediately. I remember we walked up a fairly high ramp and then into the examining rooms. And up on the top of the ramp was a man, but check your eyes. Then, of course, we had to have enough papers, health certificate and birth certificate and marriage certificate, all in triplicate. And we, of course, had to leave that there. And I don't know that I went through really serious examination of any sort. Before you know, I went down on the other side, down the stair, I guess, and there I naturally looked for my wife. And she wasn't there yet. So I waited there, of course, full of anxiety, because that was supposed to be our last examination. If we didn't pass, we had to go back. After all that excitement we had behind us. So, but I guess I waited just about 5 minutes and she came down with the baby. And then, of course, there was Traveler's Aid personnel galore. They spoke, of course, all languages. And I soon found the person, but spoke German, and they sent a telegram to Scotia that we would be on the way. And they must have given that we would come by train late at night.
Did you eat while you were at Ellis Island?
Yes, we did. There was a buffet. As we both met and we right away steered for that buffet, there was all sorts of, oh, great big bowls of oranges. And bigger than we ever seen oranges before. It must have been the California oranges. And then they had pies there. We didn't know what a pie was. So my wife pointed at an apple pie. I want a piece of that apple pie, or apple kuchen, she called it. And then as she had the first taste, she shook her hand. She said, they forgot the sugar in this kuchen. It was tart, naturally, the way an apple pie should be. She felt they forgot the sugar in that kuchen.
Was this food that was just offered to the people after they were... You didn't pay for this, did you?
I don't really know. I almost think we did pay for it. But we took along, of course, on the train then.
Were there a lot of people at Ellis Island?
Oh, yes. Well, there must have been other ships that had come in at the same time, too, so there was quite a commotion there. There we was, of course, handed a tack, which was fastened on our outer clothing, which apparently said, ask police and conductors, train conductors and police, to be sure that these people got to their right destination. So that was our Schenectady on as a destination. And
so when you got to Schenectady, you had a flat all waiting for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have about 10 more minutes. So talk to me about what it was like assimilating into America.
Well, that was another hard thing. Now, of course, her cousin of hers was an invalid, and she gave us the first English lessons, too, so that at least my aunt sent me up to the store, and she had written on a piece of paper a loaf of bread and a pound of bacon. Now, I was supposed to go and get that. So, okay, I traveled on and on the way. I read that over and over so that I tell the man what I wanted, not show him the piece of paper. And I was proud to, like a little boy, to come home and had that loaf of bread and a pound of bacon.
Was it hard for you as an adult to learn the language and to learn the customs?
Yes. Well, especially, I got the job. See, we came here in the middle of February, and then I did not have a job until finally a job opened in the General Electric in the induction motor division with one was as a sweeper and the other as a machinist. Naturally, I never had worked in a machine shop either. And so I didn't want to be a sweeper either. So I decided to ask for that machinist job. And I got it all right. And of course, but they had mostly automatic machinery. So all you had to do was chuck a raw casting or something into the machine and then start the machine off and then go to the next machine, do the same thing. And the machine did the work automatically. There was tool setters that did this, set these things to give the proper dimensions and all. And so the operators, all they had to do was they worked piecework and got paid for so many pieces on the end of the day or the end of the week, whichever it was. And, well, in the... I, of course, had learned a few words, like I knew what a pound of bacon looked like, a loaf of bread. But I pointed at the big pile of gears, change gears, but laid on the floor. And as the operator what broke me in, what do you call that? He probably said gears. But in the nose of the machinery, the big machine shop, I wasn't sure whether he said gears or deers. Both sounded alike. So after a while, of course, when I finally, I worked there probably 8 months, when I found out that they had people or somebody that was supposed to have charge of all the foreign workers to help them to get become citizens eventually. And we had classes in the works after working hours where young student engineers was our teachers. And we had the, we and our government. I had that thing for 5 years. And on the end was the Constitution of the United States. And I, after 5 years, I knew the whole Constitution by heart. So when I had a peer, when I wanted to, 1930, wanted to get my citizen papers, the examiner naturally came and checked what you knew about your government and whether you're or not could read or write. And so he asked me a couple of questions, and I answered them almost directly like the Constitution said, see. And he looked at me, and then I thought, oh, now he's going to think of a very tough question. And, of course, again, as he asked, I answered him exactly about the way the Constitution said it. So he finally said, if I had a medal, I would award you a medal for answering those questions the way you did. So I was through, and I had, of course, a cousin of my wife's but was with me in the courthouse. And as I was finished already, now, she looked at me in surprise. Are you finished already? I said, yeah. So... then, of course, later on, shortly after that, of course, we had to appear before the church and were sworn in as citizens. But what was very difficult for me was the mechanical, the words for the various mechanical things, like the gears and screws and nuts and the various threads and all that. And somehow or another, after working there for 10 months, I was asked to help the tool setter that set all these automatic machines up and was then responsible for the final outcome of the dimensions and everything, whether I would help him. I said, doesn't make any difference to me as long as I have work and bring money home. That meant, of course, I no longer worked piecework, and... I had a piecework. We usually would get about 90 cents an hour, roughly, at that time. And there, when I went back to day work again, that reduced my hourly pay to 60 cents. I had broken in the first couple of weeks with 55 cents an hour. And there I went again down to... as long as I had kept on working, because when I first saw the amount of bearings we in the smaller shop, we produced bearings, babbitted bearings, sleeve bearings, the way we call them, where the rotors would run in. I saw really practically mountains of those bearings. And I knew from my experience in Germany how long a bearing would live. We never burned a bearing out that I knew in the motor out there. And I said, where the heck do they use that many bearings in this place? Well, of course, we built after a while in the 20s, 28, 29. We built as many as 1,000 motors, 25 horsepower up to 200 horsepower. 1,000 a week.
A huge operation.
Right.
I have a question for you. You've told us sort of the positive side of being an immigrant.
Yeah.
Did you ever experience any prejudice against you?
No.
Anything like that?
Reading this, book, I have it somewhere. If I could find it quickly, I could show you. Reading that and the Constitution, that I thought that was the most wonderful document that I ever had read. And I became right away an enthusiastic citizen as soon as I had my citizen papers, my wife got them too. And so both of us felt that way.
But no one insulted you or made fun
of you? Well, yes, naturally. We were called greenhorns, of course, when you started. There was an awful lot of Germans worked in that part of the of that shop. And they were quite helpful, even though we had a foreman, but also was of German descent, and he more or less called me greenhorn. And he didn't seem to want to help me much. But most of them were willing to show me or ask when I asked questions to help me. And so I sailed through that fairly good.
What was the biggest difference between Germany and America?
Oh, another thing is, in the management office, like the superintendents, they called me by my first name. They said, Fred. And, well, out in Germany, they would have never said anything like that by calling me by my first name, no matter how well they knew me. Always Pfeiffer, not Fred. Here, I felt part of this big, an important tooth in this big gear system. I thought, well, that is democracy. That is what democracy represents. And so, naturally, we became, both of us, enthusiastic citizens later on, too. We never missed an election either in all those years.
My final question for you of the interview is, are you happy you came here? Was that the right thing to do at that
time? Yes. In fact, later on, as we went into the Second World War, by then I had done outstanding work. In fact, I was 8 years with the General Electric when I got the gold medal and a big plaque, which I have on the wall out here, for improving the machinery of his department. And that was quite an honor. That was paid of 140,000 employees of all the plants of the General Electric. They picked out 12 men, two from the shops, two from engineering, two from sales, and so on. And they got that award each year. And not only the gold medal, there was also a fairly substantial money award with it too. And so that was a very high honor. And I got that after in 1933, which of course we was right in the middle of the Depression. We did not build many motors anymore. Our motors, the weekly production went from 1,000 motors down to the lowest I ever knew was 35 a week.
Wow, but that's a substantial.
Yeah, okay. And of course they laid off everybody too. They laid off people but had 25 years service while I stayed on. I had, by then, had obtained through this tool setting thing on automatic turret lathes, I had gained a tremendous skill. And also they, at that time, in 1927, introduced the new cutting tools, which was a Krupp patent, Krupp Germany patent. And the General Electric had that board and produced it yet in the research laboratory here. And so they told me when they brought the first tool, what I was supposed to dry out, 1 pound of that material cost $5,000. So it looked to me like diamonds, naturally. It was almost as hard as a diamond, too. The Germans called it wie Diamant, like a diamond. And we, General Electric, had their patent name was Carbolloy. And the Carbolloy company today is quite an important subsidiary of General Electric.
So America gave you the opportunity to do all of this.
Right. And at the same time, I met, they had the suggestion system too. Every once in a while, I had a new idea to improve the speed or whatever was necessary, or prevent spoilage or something like that. I got, suggestions award from $15, $25, $50, even $250. Well, during the Depression years, when we only worked 3 days a week, that was an important thing, that you could get here and there an extra dollar.
Sure. Well, Mr. Pfeiffer, I want to thank you very much for allowing me to come out here. I know we tried to do this a year ago.
Yeah,
and it's taken me a year to get back in contact with you, but I'm very glad
I did. It's a pleasure for me, anyhow.
It's been a
And
been
here,
wonderful.
Of course, in the years since I had only grade school education in Germany, because I started working for 14 years in the blacksmith shop, I actually, the last 10 years here, I was appointed manufacturing engineer in a motor section.
That's wonderful.
Who was responsible for the methods and equipment of the whole department. So
you've come a long way.
Yes, yes.
You've come a long
so
way.
So I'm actually has been a wonderful thing for me, and it always was. And of course, we have traveled. Once we had a home of our own and had that reasonably paid for, that's when we bought a car finally, and also a telephone.
All the modern conveniences.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, since I never traveled in Germany, had no chance to travel in Germany, I read, of course. Always was an avid reader from a small boy on. I was, I guess, 9 or 10 years old when I read the Leather Stocking Tales of Fenimore Cooper.
Sure.
Which, of course, I never at that time never realized that I would live practically a lifetime in that very section.
That's right. Isn't that interesting? The beginning of your life.
Yeah.
You were reading about Schenectady and Glasgow.
Out there, my mother didn't want me to read the Indian stories or anything like that, so I had to hide the book in the haystack in the barn. And she had this covered, and of course, I probably got the spanking for that too.
Well, we have to sign off now.
Yeah.
So this
yeah.
is Paul Sigrist signing off for the National Park Service with Frederick Pfeiffer. Thank you.
Yeah.